Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are focusing our analytic lens on a figure who, well, for many of us is maybe defined by those like 3 minutes of perfect, slightly nerdy pop rock that really defined the mid-90s. You're having Rivers Cuomo, the frontman guitarist, and, you know, the primary songwriter for Weezer.
Yeah, and it is remarkably easy to just sort of contain Rivers Cuomo within that box of geek rock pioneer, right? But our source material, this incredibly detailed biographical profile, it tells a story that is just. It's far more challenging, rigorous, and frankly, intellectually restless than that public image suggests. Mm-hmm. This is an artist defined not just by talent, but by this relentless intellectual pursuit. Almost severe self-experimentation, you could say, and a commitment to composition that relies on like structured systems and spreadsheets, not just, you know, raw emotion.
Yeah, exactly. Our mission today is really to cut through the Blue Album and Green Album nostalgia, you know, and uncover the core operating system of this man. We need to understand how he transformed from, well, a struggling glam metal musician into a dedicated Harvard scholar and then back again, and how he used that academic rigor to kind of revolutionize his own approach to pop composition. We're going deep on the contradiction at his core here.
Okay, so to set the stage, we have some essential starting points. Rivers Cuomo was born June 13th, 1970, in New York City. His early life was immediately unconventional. I mean, he spent his formative years really immersed in Buddhist communities, moving from the Rochester Zen Center to Yogaville, which was an ashram in Connecticut, until he was about 10 years old.
Right, and that early life, you feel like it informs pretty much everything that comes after. Think about the scope of his musical evolution, too. I mean, his genres include alternative rock, power pop, pop punk, indie rock. But you really can't ignore that foundational phase in glam metal. That's kind of wild. Mm. He controls the vocals, guitar, the keys, and he's just a case study in using intellect to almost force artistic reinvention. Mm. So let's unpack how these spiritual and artistic origins kind of clashed.
Okay, starting with his parentage, we see this blend of roots, Italian descent on his father, Frank Cuomo's side, and German-English on his mother, Beverly Schumberger's side. And his father, Frank Cuomo, was a working musician himself. He notably played drums on Wayne Shorter's 1971 album, Odyssey of Ischia.
Wow, okay.
So that foundation of professional musicianship was there, right? But it was coming from this pretty sophisticated world of jazz, not necessarily mainstream pop.
And the naming of Rivers. It's almost a wonderful metaphor for the two worlds he would later inhabit, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Our sources give us two really distinct origin stories. One account attributes the name to simple sort of geographical poetry. You know, the East and Hudson Rivers in Manhattan.
Right.
But the other, which his father claimed, attributes it to 1970 World Cup soccer players. Rivellino, Gigi Riva, and Gianni Rivera.
It's beautiful, isn't it? That duality. He's either named after this, like, eternal flow of nature or after a structured competitive sport that requires highly defined rules and strategy. Mm. That duality is just the perfect key, I think, for understanding his entire career.
Yeah, it really sets things up. And his early life was marked by this extreme movement. He goes from New York City into the Zen Center, then to the Yogaville Ashram in Pomfret, Connecticut. These are, you know, communal spiritual environments rooted in these ascetic principles. Pretty intense for a kid.
Definitely. But when Yogaville relocated to Virginia in 1980, his family stayed in Connecticut, settling in the Storrs Mansfield area. So he transitioned from an ashram into, well, regular American public schools, Mansfield Middle School and E.O. Smith High School.
That contrast is just...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's stark. After a childhood spent navigating communal spirituality, what does the adolescent Rivers Cuomo do? He immediately seeks the ultimate stage, right? He's in the choir. He performs in Greece as Johnny Cassino.
Oh.
He was actively trying on different personas. And he attended a summer program at the prestigious Berklee College of Music, which shows that, you know, serious musical intent was always there, even then.
Mm-hmm. And the identity exploration goes even further during this time. For a significant period in high school, he actually changed his name to Peter Kitts. That was his stepfather's name. It wasn't until after high school graduation that he reverted back to Rivers Cuomo.
Okay, so why do you think that need to redefine himself to become Peter Kitts, why was that so strong? And what does it maybe signal about his later habit of, you know, artistic reinvention?
Well, I think it signals a profound sense of searching, maybe.
Yeah.
When you're raised in a really non-traditional environment like an ashram, you often spend adolescence trying to find some kind of clear conventional identity to latch onto.
Right.
Peter Kitts was a conventional name. It fit the high school environment. Maybe it reflected a desire for normalcy, you know. But then the return to Rivers Cuomo with its sort of eccentric, conflicting origins, it suggests he maybe embraced his uniqueness right when he was about to launch his professional life.
And that professional launch was, well, it was anything but normal for the future Weezer frontman. Right. We absolutely have to talk about the pre-Weezer period, the full-blown glam metal phase. It's just, yeah. His band was called Avant-Garde, and they made that pilgrimage from Connecticut out to Los Angeles in 1989.
Yeah, the classic move.
They later changed the name to Zoom, but then broke up in 1990. I mean, the image alone, Rivers Cuomo in full glam metal regalia, it's conceptually challenging for most fans today, I think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's crucial because it wasn't just some stylistic detour. It was a rejection, ultimately. The sources show the real turning point happened after the breakup. He was working at Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard. That's actually where he met future drummer Patrick Wilson.
Oh, okay.
And he was also roadieing for a band called King Size, and he was suddenly just immersed in the emerging sounds of the time.
Right. He started absorbing the whole alternative movement. Nirvana, the Pixies, Sonic Youth, big influences. But critically, he didn't just reject metal for grunge. He simultaneously absorbed the masterful, you know, structured classic songwriting of the Beach Boys and the Beatles.
Yeah, that combination is key.
And here is the key psychological insight from the sources, I think, regarding the creation of Weezer.
Yeah.
He actively suppressed his metal past.
Yes, that anxiety about authenticity. It's fascinating, isn't it? In the early 90s alternative scene, metal was kind of seen as this corporate joke, right? To be credible, you had to be authentic. So he intentionally buried the glam metal phase. He created the persona of the self-deprecating, slightly awkward rock genius, a persona that felt much more authentic to the era than, you know, shredded leather and hairspray. And that suppression arguably fueled the early Weezer identity.
So that new identity led directly to the formation of Weezer in 1992, with Wilson, Matt Sharp, and Jason Cropper. And the name Weezer apparently was the nickname his father had given him when he was a toddler. Another one of those personal, slightly awkward details woven into their whole anti-rock star identity.
Mm-hmm. And the Blue Album in 1994 was just an explosion of success. Signed to DGC, platinum certified by 1995. This is also where Jason Cropper was replaced mid-recording by Brian Bell, and that iconic lineup was set. But success, for most artists, that's the goal, right? But for Cuomo, success became this massive psychological burden.
Yeah, that's what's so contradictory about him. The sources state he developed a huge inferiority complex about rock music itself. Why would massive validated success breed such intense dissatisfaction? It seems counterintuitive.
Well, he fundamentally viewed his own catchy songs as simplistic and silly. That's how he put it. He found the structure of touring monotonous, lonely. This isn't just like typical self-doubt. It's an intellectual rejection of the very form he'd mastered.
Huh.
He wasn't satisfied with writing perfect pop songs. He felt compelled to seek a greater complexity. And that's what drove him toward classical composition and academia. He wanted the intellectual rigor that rock, you know, in his view, lacked.
And this intellectual breaking point coincided with a really profound physical challenge in March 1995. This detail is often glossed over, I think, but it's vital to understanding the tone of his next work. He underwent the extensive Elizarov procedure to correct his left leg, which was 44 millimeters. That's nearly 2 inches shorter than his right.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate how brutal this procedure was. The Elizarov method involves, like, surgically breaking the bone.
Wow.
And then affixing this massive external steel brace. Over months, the patient has to manually turn screws to stretch the gap 4 times a day.
Oh, my God.
He was literally breaking and stretching his own leg slowly, painfully, over a long period. He described the pain as crucifying his leg.
That image is haunting. You have a platinum-selling rock star intentionally subjecting himself to months of excruciating pain and confinement. How did this physical trauma directly impact his creative output? We know.
Well, our sources confirm that being hospitalized and under the influence of painkillers, it fundamentally altered his perspective and his writing process. You know, confinement, isolation, constant agonizing pain. It led his songwriting to become immediately darker, more visceral, intensely personal. This physical breaking point was almost like the necessary precursor for the next artistic stage. It really set the tone for the deeply wounded, complex music he was about to create.
Right. And this physical and mental stress immediately catalyzed his academic turn. While he was still recovering, he enrolled at Harvard University. late 1995.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just a celebrity taking a few classes for fun, right? This is a focused pursuit of classical composition.
Oh, totally dedicated. His goal was explicitly to learn how to write complex, intense, beautiful music. That's a quote. The sources paint this picture of just total immersion. He told the New York Times the only time he allowed himself to write rock songs was when my frozen dinner was in the microwave.
That's commitment.
Yeah, the artistic focus was absolutely zeroed in on his studies.
And the rock star persona just completely dissolved. He became intensely introverted, grew this large beard, and famously went unrecognized by students on campus who were literally wearing Weezer t-shirts.
Yeah, incredible.
He was fully committed to the life of a Harvard student. And the fact that he failed an audition for the Harvard Radcliffe Collegium Musicum Chorus, that kind of underscores that this was a serious, humbling academic challenge. This wasn't a sabbatical. He basically put the rock identity completely on hold to become this dedicated, maybe even struggling scholar.
Right. And this period of isolation and formal study led directly to his most critically debated work. Initially, he conceived of Weezer's second album as this sprawling concept rock opera called Songs from the Black Hole. Highly ambitious, clearly reflecting his new classical aspirations.
But the sources indicate that the conceptual nature was abandoned because his writing just became far too, well, darker, more visceral and exposed, less playful.
Hmm.
So the structured opera concept kind of gave way to raw, painful reality. What musical influences were driving this shift specifically?
Well, his deep dive into classical composition led him to absorb major operas. He specifically cited Puccini's Madama Butterfly and Verdi's Aida. And alongside those, rock operas like Jesus Christ Superstar. These works, you know, they focus on dramatic pathos, doomed romance, profound isolation. They heavily influenced the creation of Pinkerton and really transformed the emotional landscape of his songs.
And that internal turmoil manifested in the masterpiece, or maybe controversial masterpiece, Pinkerton, released in September 1996. The album is an intensely uncomfortable listen for some people, right? Expressing that acute isolation, the anxiety, the sexual frustration he felt while trying to balance rock stardom with academic life at Harvard.
Yeah, it's raw. And tragically, its initial reception was just devastating for him. It was a commercial and critical failure at the time. Critics who had praised the Blue Album's simplicity were really turned off by Pinkerton's raw intensity and its, you know, literary ambition. And this failure led to a 3-year hiatus for Weezer. Imagine pouring your intellectual and physical suffering into a work only for it to be rejected so publicly.
Oof, yeah. But that failure didn't send him back to the stadium, interestingly. It sent him back to the library. He doubled down on his academic pursuit in isolation. It sort of reflects a pattern, doesn't it? Retreating inward when facing professional adversity.
Yeah.
He re-enrolled at Harvard twice more in 1997 and then in 2004.
Yeah. And during that 1997 semester, he also had that short-lived side project called Homie in Boston. But he quickly disbanded it, apparently finding the recording sessions with the rest of Weezer unproductive at that time.
But the most extreme example of this withdrawal, I think, was his self-imposed isolation between 1998 and 1999. He was living in Culver City, California, literally under a freeway.
Right. The details of this isolation are just staggering. He actively created this sensory deprivation chamber in his apartment. He unplugged the phone, painted his bedroom walls black, covered the windows with fiberglass insulation. I mean, what does that kind of deliberate extreme isolation tell us about his mental state and maybe his creative methodology? Well, it doesn't sound like just depression, right? It sounds like intentional asceticism, almost a creative experiment.
Yeah.
Designed to eliminate external stimuli and force internal focus. He wrote an essay for Harvard detailing how he became more and more isolated. He was trying to eliminate the self that existed in the world, you know, the rock star, the failed academic, to get back to some kind of pure, unadulterated core creative voice. It shows a level of intensity and dedication to his mental process that's, well, it's almost unnerving.
Yeah, absolutely. And despite all these setbacks, the initial failure of Pinkerton, the intense isolation, he did achieve his academic goal. He returned and finally graduated cum laude with a Bachelor of Arts in English from Harvard in June 2006. That's almost a decade after his first enrollment. He was also elected to Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah, and we should probably take a moment just to maybe define the weight of those achievements for people who aren't familiar with the U.S. academic system. Graduating cum laude means he graduated with high honors. That's typically a GPA in the top 20% of his class at Harvard. And Phi Beta Kappa is the oldest academic honor society in the U.S., reserved for students with extremely high scholastic achievement in liberal arts and sciences.
Right.
These weren't like easy degrees for a touring musician to just pick up on the side. They required deep, rigorous, sustained commitment. It really proves that the scholarly pursuit was absolutely fundamental to his character. It wasn't just a phase.
Okay, so following the commercial rejection of Pinkerton, Cuomo made a very intentional and, you could say, strategic artistic shift. He realized that the deeply personal, complex approach had failed commercially. And this is kind of the birth of what we're calling the pop philosophy.
Right. And the shift wasn't a retreat into ignorance or anything. It was more like an application of his critical Harvard training to a new target, pure pop. He moved towards simpler, cleaner songwriting, deliberately making the lyrics, quote, not about me.
Mm.
So the Green Album in 2001 and Maladroit in 2002 were really born from this mindset, focusing on structure over autobiography.
But tell me, how did his classical study inform this new appreciation for pop? Because he had gone to Harvard partly to reject rock as simple. Now he's embracing pop simplicity. What was the philosophical reconciliation there?
Well, he developed this deep value for pop music. He started viewing it not as intellectually inferior, but as a multifaceted art. That's his term. He recognized that pop requires mastering multiple disciplines, lyrics, harmony, arrangement, improvisation, even image, right?
Yeah.
And that, crucially, pop music is culturally relevant in a way that, quote, serious classical music isn't right now. So he started treating pop composition like this complex, maybe three-dimensional engineering problem that required structured solutions.
Okay, so he was applying the analytic framework he learned studying, say, Guccini, to dissecting songs by Nirvana or Oasis, figuring out how they achieved emotional impact with minimal elements.
Precisely, yeah. And this commitment to clean, structured architecture extended to his public image, too. His lyrics very rarely use profanity. And he explicitly viewed this clean image, which kind of echoed the wholesome approach of the Beach Boys, as an ironically rebellious stance, you know, against the controversial, shock-focused rock culture of the 1990s. While everyone else was trying to be provocative, he found provocation in purity.
Interesting. And while Weezer was on that hiatus, he kept busy experimenting with these new philosophies. His band Homie, for instance, focused on goofball songs for his country band, apparently. It shows he needed an outlet for just pure, unserious fun. Though only one studio recording, American Girls, was officially released from that, he also showed an interest in the business side, managing the band AM Radio for a couple of years. Their frontman was an old schoolmate, apparently.
Mm-hmm. And it's also vital to remember that despite the intellectual focus, he continued to face serious physical adversity. In December 2009, he was involved in that serious tour bus crash in Glen, New York. He suffered cracked ribs and internal bleeding. It forced Weezer to cancel performances well into 2010. Rivers Cuomo's career is just punctuated by these jarring stops and restarts, often driven by extreme physical or psychological events.
Yeah, it's a recurring theme, isn't it? Okay, this is the section where we really get into the pure Rivers Cuomo mechanism. The reason he is so unique, I think, among his peers, he doesn't just write songs, he sort of engineers them. His process, which he detailed extensively on the Song Exploder podcast, reveals this highly systematic approach that seems designed entirely to defeat creative habit.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Let's start with melody generation. When he's composing vocal melodies, he insists on using the piano. He does this specifically because he wants to avoid the familiar patterns and the muscle memory he naturally falls into on the guitar. He needs that unfamiliarity of the piano to generate novel, maybe unexpected vocal lines.
Right. And he applies a similar kind of restriction to guitar solos, doesn't he? He doesn't initially play them, he vocally improvises them. What's the genius behind that technique?
Well, the genius is structural, really. When you sing a solo, you have to physically pause to breathe, right? This mandatory need to inhale introduces natural space and silence into the melodic line that a guitarist just playing constantly might never create.
Okay.
The resulting solos are inherently melodic. They create solos you can sing along to, as he put it. He is literally using his own physical limitations, the need to breathe, to define the architecture of the music.
That's fantastic. He's imposing a limitation to force a signature sound.
Mm.
That's clever. And his process for gathering inspiration is equally mechanical, almost. He maintains extensive Spotify playlists organized not by genre or mood, but by specific chord progressions for new ideas.
Yeah, he's essentially compiling a database of harmonic structure. So
yeah.
If he needs a specific emotional color, like a certain minor chord resolution, he knows exactly where in his library to find examples of it. Furthermore, he's experimented with pretty radical physical methods like fasting, believing that the resulting state of physical deprivation and mental clarity will actually aid the songwriting process.
Wow. This commitment to external structure leads us to the most famous and maybe the most analytical part of this method, the spreadsheet approach to lyrics.
Hmm.
Can you walk us through this step by step? Because it sounds like a nightmare for any conventional lyricist.
Oh, it's totally the antithesis of the tortured poet. Yeah. It's basically a three-stage system. Step one is simply stream of consciousness journaling. He just writes down anything that comes into his head, regardless of relevance or coherence, just raw data dump.
Okay.
Step two, he goes back and highlights only the most interesting lines or phrases. This is where he extracts the raw linguistic material he likes.
So far, so normal-ish.
Yeah.
But then comes the engineering part.
Then comes step three, organizing those highlighted phrases into a massive spreadsheet. And this spreadsheet categorizes them by cold structural metrics. The two main columns are syllable count and strong weak emphasis. He's not sorting by theme or feeling or narrative. He's sorting by rhythm.
So if the melody he's written has, say, three syllables that require a weak, strong, weak emphasis, like the phrase, the deep dive, he can instantly find a phrase in his spreadsheet that matches that rhythmic pattern, even if the phrase is completely disconnected from the rest of the song's theme.
Exactly. He is allowing the musical structure, the rhythmic pattern, to select the lyrics rather than forcing the lyrics into the music. This process ensures the lyrical structure perfectly fits the vocal line. And crucially, it allows him to surprise himself sometimes. It forces disconnected lines to suggest a story he maybe never intended to write. The resulting lyrics often feel simple and universal, but they are the end product of this intense structural engineering applied to raw emotion.
Amazing. Okay, let's look at the influences that inspired this very analytic approach. We mentioned the importance of the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. That story of the coin toss is so telling, isn't it?
It really is a decisive moment. He went to a used record shop, determined to buy a classic album that would influence Weezer. It apparently came down to Led Zeppelin and Pet Sounds. He chose Pet Sounds almost on a whim, based on that coin toss, but he connected immediately with its melodies, its chord progression, its emotional resonance. Had he chosen Zeppelin? Well, Weezer might have sounded fundamentally different, maybe leaning back toward metal. Who knows?
Yeah, fascinating. What if? And the classical influence, specifically opera, remains crucial too. The dramatic flair, the use of leitmotifs, the deep emotional arcs of operas like Aida and Madama Butterfly, they clearly fuel the ambition of Pinkerton and that abandoned songs from the Black Hole Project.
Absolutely. But perhaps the greatest evidence of his scholarly process is that Encyclopedia of Pop. This wasn't just passive listening. In the late 1990s, he created this physical three-ring binder where he systematically analyzed the pop and rock songs of the time, artists like Nirvana, Green Day, Oasis. He wasn't just listening. He was dissecting chord progressions, melodic peaks, lyrical structures, trying to figure out why these songs were commercially and artistically successful. He was literally building his own textbook for pop success.
Incredible. And his gear seems to reflect this duality of tradition and optimization, too. For the Blue Album, he used classic vintage equipment. Gibson Les Paul models, a borrowed Fender Jaguar, a vintage Mesa Boogie Mark iAmp. That's pure raw rock tone, right?
Yeah, classic sound. But as his goals evolved, so did his equipment. He transitioned to these highly customized Warmoth Fender Stratocaster copies for touring, prioritizing reliability and specific playability over vintage mojo, maybe? And more recently, he's adopted modern profiling technology, specifically the Kemper Profiler Amp, which allows him to digitally model and replicate the sound of any classic amp without relying on fragile vintage gear. This shift just reflects his core philosophy. Optimize structure and performance to maintain consistent output.
Right. It makes perfect sense for him. And just to close the loop on that early metal history, it's interesting to note that during the 2021 Hell Omega tour, he was seen playing a Jackson Rhodes guitar, which is a very specific shred-focused instrument. It proves he can still subtly pay homage to that foundational, often suppressed metal past when he wants to.
Yeah, little nods here and there. And Rivers Cuomo's willingness to collaborate, that really demonstrates that his analytic approach works across almost every genre. He shows incredible flexibility, adapting his, you know, highly structured melodies to really diverse tracks.
Yeah, his feature credits span the entire modern musical landscape, don't they? From hip-hop with B.O.B. on Magic to pop-punk with Simple Plan. Even Miranda Cosgrove's pop track, High Maintenance.
Mm-hmm. But perhaps the most telling recent collaboration, the one that really proves the success of his pop philosophy, was his work with AJR on Sober Up. Cuomo co-wrote and featured on the track, and it hit number one on the Billboard Alternative Charts. This proved his structured songwriting could translate directly into mainstream chart-topping success decades after his debut. And he also crossed generational boundaries, writing She Makes Me Laugh for the Monkees, showcasing his ability to write just timeless power pop.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And his genre flexibility isn't just limited to the U.S. market either. You have to discuss Scott and Rivers, his Japanese language project with Scott Murphy. They released a self-titled album in 2013 that debuted at number one on the iTunes Japan Alternative Charts. That shows a profound dedication to engaging with foreign markets and mastering entirely new linguistic structures.
Amazing.
Which must appeal to his structured methodology, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that engagement with foreign language and community continues right up to today.
Yeah.
In 2022, he released an Indonesian language cover of Chrissy's Anak Sekolah. And what makes this particularly modern and insightful is that the idea came directly from his Discord server. He actually asked fans for suggestions of Indonesian songs he could perform during a Weezer show in Jakarta.
Wow, that connects his intense archival nature with direct community engagement. That's pretty cool. He is constantly seeking input, storing data, and executing new musical challenges. And speaking of archives, he is the ultimate demo collector, isn't he?
Oh, totally. The Alone series of demo compilations, I and Three, including the Pinkerton years, they're just comprehensive collections of his creative process, sometimes accompanied by books like the Pinkerton Diaries. But in 2020, he really escalated this archival effort, releasing over 2,000 demos and home recordings online via these Weezify demo bundles spanning volumes Alone the 4th through Alone the 13th. This isn't just artistic sharing, it's like an almost academic need to document every single stage of his creative life.
Yeah, it's exhaustive. Finally, let's explore the deep personal interests that seem to underpin his stability, especially his commitment to structure and aestheticism. We mentioned his spiritual upbringing, and that continues today. From 2003 until his marriage in 2006, he took a vow of sexual abstinence, and he viewed his celibacy as a positive, stabilizing influence on the creative environment around the 2005 album, Make Believe.
Right. He married Kyoko Ito in 2006, whom he'd met back in 1997. His commitment to structured spirituality is also evident in his practice of Vipassana meditation. He's a student of S.N. Goenka and even teaches children's meditation. He financially supported the Dhamma Brothers documentary about Vipassana meditation in a prison setting. This just shows that the desire for control, focus, and structure permeates his private life just as much as his music.
Mm-hmm. And then there's soccer. The very sport that might have influenced his name has remained this lifelong interest. He's written tribute songs like My Day Is Coming and that unofficial 2010 World Cup anthem, Represent. He also participates in celebrity soccer challenges. It's a clean, structured sport. Maybe it satisfies that part of his brain that loves rules and defined victories.
It could be. And that love for structure carries directly into his most recent scholarly pursuit. Coding. Computer programming. He took the famous Harvard CS50 computer science course, he maintains a GitHub profile, and he actively runs his own Discord server. This just confirms that the critical problem-solving mindset, the one that fueled his Harvard degree, created the pop encyclopedia, drove the spreadsheet method, is now being applied to computer programming and digital community building. It seems like he sees the world as a series of systems that can be analyzed and ultimately optimized. Hashtag tag outro.
So we've spent this deep dive tracing the winding path of Rivers Cuomo. And what we find is not just a musician, but a deeply dedicated systems architect. He is the stadium rock star who simultaneously lives the highly focused, almost ascetic life of a scholar.
Yeah, he's defined by this rigorous intellectual study, whether it's pursuing high honors at Harvard, dissecting pop songs in his encyclopedia, or learning to code. And by physically intense challenges, from that Ilizarov procedure to his fasting experiments, these self-imposed hardships almost seem like necessary inputs for his creative output.
And what he reveals to us, I think, is that the ability to distill complex thoughts and personal trauma into deceptively simple, perfectly polished pop rock, well, it's not necessarily a feat of spontaneous genius. It seems to be a direct result of applying academic rigor and critical analysis, like the spreadsheet method, to the raw material of music. He constantly analyzes why a melody or a phrase works before he even attempts to create something new. He's the ultimate meta musician, always questioning the formula, always seeking to optimize the structure.
Yeah, it really forces us to reconsider the definition of rock star. For Cuomo, maybe the ultimate act of rock and roll isn't rebellion, but mastery. Control.
So we leave you with this provocative thought to mull over. We've seen Rivers Cuomo methodically analyze everything from Puccini to the Pixies, and he's now applying his critical thinking to computer science. Given his coding background and his systematic process, what hidden algorithms do you think he applied to his biggest, most commercially successful songs to guarantee their, you know, ubiquity? And if he sees life as a series of analyzable systems, how does his lifelong love of soccer reflect his approach to composition? Is music, for Rivers Cuomo, fundamentally a structured game to be mastered? Think about that intellectual weight the next time a catchy Weezer hook gets stuck in your head.